The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. I'm sure you guys were all enthralled with the conversation we had with Andrea Burkhart last week about the Delphi trial, Richard Allen's trial. And she's back with us again this week to now take us through what's happened since the conviction. And as you guys know, I actually don't follow a whole lot of true crime and I get busy with other things. So I don't know much of what's happened since then. I know there's a lot of appeals that are happening and a lot of things in the works. So Andrea's going to help us break down what's been going on since the conviction. Andrea, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
So I'm just going to let you take it away and then we'll ask questions along because I really don't know what's been happening. I see, you know, the occasional X posts and Instagram reels of people talking about things that are going on. But what's been happening since Richard Allen was convicted last year?
Well, this is actually a fairly quick answer because the answer is it's been on appeal and direct appeals, which are where the reviewing court is looking at the process in the trial court to see if there has been some kind of legal error that undermines the reliability of the outcome. These move at a very glacial pace. And so there was an extensive amount of time where we were simply waiting for transcripts to be prepared for exhibits and filings and so forth to be transmitted up to the Court of Appeals. The sort of benefit of that process for the folks watching the case is that a lot more of the evidence was able to come to light and be publicly available as a result of that process. There, of course, were gag orders and protective orders in place for discovery materials during the trial. Judge Gohl had put a bar, basically, on the public being able to view the exhibits during the trial process. So the media was able to come up at the end of each trial day and inspect the exhibits that had been introduced that day. But we members of the public were not allowed to do that. And so this was really the first opportunity that the public had to be able to start to see a lot of what the case had been based on. And then same with a lot of the underlying litigation that happened during the pretrial process. Much of that litigation was done under seal, or the supporting evidence for it was kept under seal or just otherwise not available for the public to look at. And so the process of concluding the trial and getting the case prepared for all of that to go up to the Court of Appeals for review led to a lot more of that information becoming available. So I think more and more people have been able to scrutinize a lot more closely what this case was based on and what some of the arguments that led to the decisions about what did and didn't come in at trial to be scrutinized a lot more closely.
So procedurally, there's not a lot happening. Have they actually filed the direct appeals yet, or are those still being worked on?
Yeah, so Richard Allen filed his brief. That has been, I want to say, I can't remember the exact date now, but I think it was just earlier this month that was filed, or maybe it was in December. I lose track of time pretty easily now. I'm at that age. So we're now waiting for the state's response to be filed. There have been all kinds of snafus with the record and the documents getting sent up to the Court of Appeals and to the parties and things like that. So there's been a lot of delays just associated with getting all of the documentation together. There was another one of those just within the last week dealing with some exhibits that had not been sent up to the Court of Appeals. So the state had to request those specially. They have now arrived, but the state is going to need time to be able to review those and finish their briefing. So at this point, not expecting much before the end of February, early part of March.
For Allen's brief that was filed, mm-hmm. what are the errors that they're citing in their brief?
Well, it's pretty extensive. There's a number of errors if you look at it like individually, one by one. But they organize them in three basic categories. They argue that there were errors in, first off, the defense had filed a motion for a Franks hearing concerning the search warrant that was used to search his home. And so a Franks hearing is a special kind of motion that you file when the state has either lied in a warrant affidavit or they have omitted material information that creates a false and misleading impression. And so they had argued that there was a substantial amount of evidence that had been excluded or misrepresented or so forth in that search warrant that without it would not have been probable cause to justify the search. And so those included things like mischaracterizing the interrogation that was done and what Richard Allen actually said. His words were misrepresented. I'm trying to remember because now it's so overwhelming what all of the different issues were. But ultimately, this one, they were arguing that because Judge Gold basically just denied this motion without having any kind of hearing, the argument was that they had met the threshold for a Franks hearing by showing that there were inaccuracies in the warrant. And so it should have proceeded further to evaluate if there was probable cause for the search in the absence of those misrepresentations. And so without those, they can't search the home. Then you have an issue of what should be suppressed as a result of that. Certainly the direct fruits of the search of the home, which would include the firearm that was used to compare to the cartridge that was found at the scene and some other items as well. But the defense is also arguing that there's a direct causal link. You know, the search led to the arrest, which led to the incarceration, which led to the confessions. And so, but for the false warrant affidavit, none of that would have happened. So that's one issue that they focused on is the search of the home. They're arguing that Rick's confessions, the statements that he made while he was, I think, admittedly, on pretty much all counts, floridly psychotic, should not have been admitted against him, that the circumstances were inherently coercive, and it rendered his statements involuntary. So there's a fair amount of their brief that is devoted just to that issue. And then the last one is a series of errors relating to denial of his opportunity to present a defense. And so this includes all kinds of sub-errors, so to speak, excluding his metallurgist, excluding the third-party culprit evidence, allowing there was a hearsay moment that came up towards the end of trial where the defense had their own forensic expert to testify about Libby's cell phone and the data from Libby's cell phone and what it showed. She found data in the phone that indicated wired headphones had been plugged in at about 5:30 in the evening and then unplugged at about 10:30 at night. And so this was thoroughly inconsistent with the state's timeline of how the case went. So the state then responded to this by having their expert, Trooper Cecil, get on the stand to testify that during the break, he went out in the hall and he Googled.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
This type of reading to come up. And that according to his his Google research that it was possible dirt or water in the headphone jack could cause that type of reading to be made. So this is classic hearsay. This is so hearsay, it's an issue I've actually litigated and won on appeal. Like, you don't get to just look random stuff up on the internet and then come in and present it as evidence at trial. So they're arguing that you know, was an erroneous ruling. Just a variety of kind of miscellaneous issues like that. But I think that the really substantial one was the third party culprit evidence. And then just on a related note, the inability to explain the problems in the police investigation, the reasons why they ended up focusing on Richard Allen to the exclusion of these other leads that they didn't adequately pursue.
Yeah. And some of that third party culpability stuff also ties into the Franks memo stuff, if I remember correctly, wasn't it? Because yes. That was a lot of what was the parts that were left out of the probable cause affidavit was all these other leads that they had that they pretended didn't exist when they created the PCA.
Yeah. So that was part of it. That was actually a whole separate, like, standalone Franks motion of its own. There was a separate Franks motion that was just focusing on specific problems with the search warrant affidavit. But yeah, the Franks memo, that was what got my attention on the case way back in the day, because you don't read a document like that for every day in a criminal case. It's quite extraordinary. But the fact that this theory generated with the state, and as more and more of the investigation, the evidence about how this lead was developed and pursued and so forth, as more of that information comes out, the more it has become clear that this theory was never ruled out by anybody. It was consistently maintained as plausible by pretty much everybody that the state had look at it. So that was very much an angle that the defense wanted to pursue, because it provided an explanatory context to some of the really notable aspects of this crime, particularly the scene. There were just some very peculiar features of the crime scene that aren't really very well explained by a guy doing an opportunistic murder in the middle of the day and just getting it done and then disappearing. So the whole Franks, the Odinist theory, the ritualistic killing theory, did fit that explanatory model much, much better than the opportunistic killing did. And so the defense is arguing, look, we should have had an opportunity to be able to present to the jury the fact that the state knew all this. They had gotten all of this information. They had been told, oh, yeah, this very much looks like it could be runes. And we don't necessarily know what the runes mean. But yes, this did, in fact, take place on an Odinist holiday, something where you would expect ritualistic behavior to occur. Oh, these rituals do typically involve blood and things along those lines. So defense's position is just basically, we should be able to let the jury know that there was this whole angle that the state could have gone down and kind of did go down. And they don't really have a very good explanation for why they just let it drop and are now pursuing this guy that has no connection at all, no particular angle or network or anything like that that would tie him in with these practices that seem to be so heavily featured in this scene.
I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining, if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Well, that's the frustrating part for me as an investigator. You know, what I've seen so far from the documents is with the Odin's angle, with the Ron Logan angle, is I wouldn't have as much of a problem with them leaving that stuff out of the trial and trying to keep it out for third-party culpability if somewhere they could show me when and how it was ruled out. Mm-hmm. You know, I've said, you know, I've had some people give me a hard time. It's like, well, I'm not accusing Ron Logan, for example. What I'm saying is I'm seeing all these steps in evidence that indicate he's a very good suspect. And then you're on the internet saying he was cleared. I'm saying when and how and why. I don't see anywhere where he was. It's just like they just went a different direction and just let it stay out there, which makes it very problematic to me to then say, but you can't talk about it, even though he was still our suspect.
Well, and I think where it would have been so helpful, too, is to show the disparity between the benefit of the doubt that they gave to so many of these other suspects that they absolutely did not give to Richard Allen. And so a good example of that is the busted alibis. A number of these individuals that were under suspicion gave alibis that didn't hold up. And the one that was kind of the most absurd in my perspective was the gentleman, Elvis Fields, who told police that he was at the hospital with a friend of his. They were visiting another friend in the hospital. And when asked if his cell phone data would confirm his location there at the hospital, he explained that, oh, no, it wouldn't, because don't you know hospitals put blockers on the signals so that you can't have a cell signal coming out of the hospital. Now, of course, this is nonsense. Anybody with common sense who's ever been to the hospital and like called everybody you know to give them updates about how this person in the hospital is doing knows that that's nonsense. But police just apparently took that and let it go and never followed up on it, never pursued it any further, just took that at face value and said, okay, guess we're gonna clear this guy. So it seems that in many respects, with these other suspects, they treated the inability to develop more direct, more incriminating evidence as essentially the same thing as clearing them. They didn't do that when it came to Richard Allen. They didn't take his word for it. They started, you know, putting words in his mouth and twisting what he was saying and things like that, all the ways that they engineered the case that we talked about last time. So that contrast in how the investigation was conducted when they were looking at these other suspects versus when they were looking at Richard Allen, I think, would have been very helpful to the defense to be able to show the jury this is not good faith investigation, because they're not being consistent with how they're evaluating the evidence that's presented to them.
And that inconsistency is really baffling to me. As I mean, this is what I do. I review it, other people's investigations, and this one has been so hard for me to track and understand, because you know, they ended up, once they determined it's Richard Allen, then they're just everything. It's a suspect driven investigation. They're trying to bend everything to fit Richard Allen, and they're doing it doggedly the way they did it. Mm-hmm. But when, you know, the FBI is going after Logan and they ignore that. And then when Elvis, they're going after him and they ignore that. Richard Allen wasn't in the picture then. So it's like, it's not like they ignored it because they're trying to make a case against Richard Allen. It's just like, it looks to me just like really poor police work. And then it's like, then all of a sudden one day they're like, now we're going to shift into overdrive with this guy. It's just such a weird paradox.
And it just happens to be right at the time of the contested sheriff's election and so forth. But with Ron Logan, especially, what blows my mind about Ron Logan is that the big characteristic, the big feature of Richard Allen's irony quotes confession at trial was how it contained facts that only the killer would know. Because that is potentially very incriminating evidence. Right. If you can put words into a suspect's mouth that they wouldn't have any way of knowing unless they participated, then that's corroborative. And so the fact that only Richard Allen would have known in his confession was that he claimed in the course of committing the abduction, a white van went by and it startled him. And so he got the girls across the river and ultimately murdered them. And so that played a very important part in the story that the state gave. It since came out, and it was in the motion to correct error that was filed after the conviction and is also raised in the appeal. As it turns out, the state was in possession of a couple different sources of evidence that indicated that did not happen because he wasn't there at the right time. They have surveillance footage from the neighbor's cameras that show when his van arrived home. This is the neighbor, Brad Weber. So when Brad Weber's van arrived home was much closer to about 2:45. So we're 15 minutes too late. The girls are already dead at this point. They also have Brad Weber's cell phone data from when he started to ping basically at his house. Same thing. It's about 2:45 to 2:50 timeframe. So the prosecution knew at the time, this is actually not a fact only the killer would know, because it didn't happen like that. It couldn't have happened like that. When it comes to Ron Logan gave a confession to one of his cellmates. Now, I will be the first person to be skeptical of a jailhouse informant. I'm the first one to acknowledge there are just a lot of incentives and often pathologies that will play into why somebody will attribute statements to a cellmate. But the statement that Ron Logan gave to this cellmate, that was the cellmate reported then to the state, and the state knew about this, that contained some very intriguing details that only the killer would know. And the most specific one of those had to do with this very specific manner of death, not just that the girls' throats were cut, but that with one of them, quote unquote, nicked an artery. And so she bled out faster than the other girl. That was confirmed at trial, that this was the case, that Libby had her carotid artery severed, so she would have died very quickly. Abby did not. Abby had her jugular veins severed, so it would have been a much slower process for her to die. So this is the kind of detail that, I mean, I don't know how anybody would possibly know that unless they were either privy to the autopsy and the findings and so forth, or if they were there witnessing it themselves. And yet the police showed little to no interest in following up on that, in trying to verify that, or even using that to the same degree that they tried to use his own words against Richard Allen to support a prosecution.
I covered that confession, or the jailhouse informant about the confession, extensively when it came out, because that one I was able to dig my teeth into, because not only was that detail so specific and so correct and accurate, but also that was at a time where no one even knew their throats were slit until trial. For the most part, no one knew that was even how they died. I remember for years I was like, everybody was always wanting me to analyze this case. I'm like, I don't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. I know nothing about it. I can't do that. And for someone in a prison who has even less access to information to come up with that is, yeah, that was one of the biggest reasons. I'm like, this seems like, I'll put it this way, me as a non-attorney, whether he's innocent or guilty, I feel like I could have went to trial and convicted Ron Logan.
Mm-hmm.
Just with the evidence that they have. I mean, that is so much more compelling to me than anything that they had against Richard Allen.
Sure.
I do want to real quick circle back to something that we talked about 20 minutes ago. You touched on it. I just want to get a real clear explanation on it. The whole fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about the search warrant, if the search warrant was decided to be invalid,
mm-hmm.
I was going to say typically, but there probably isn't a typically, but I was wondering, and you touched on it a little bit, how far can that go? You know, because like, mm-hmm. can that go as far as, and that's, you know, if they never, you like you mentioned, if they never had the right to search his home, then they can't use the gun. That's obviously fruit of the poisonous tree.
Mm-hmm.
But the gun is the reason they were then able to arrest him. The reason they were able to, once they arrested him, that's the reason that he was in jail. And that's why he was put into the conditions he was put into. And that's why he was talking to Dr. Walla, and that's where the confessions came from. So like, how far does that fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine go with the evidence?
Yeah, it's a great question, because you run into a little bit of the butterfly flapping its wings and changing the weather around the world mm-hmm. kind of phenomenon. You know, we exist in time. And so, you know, to a certain extent, everything kind of flows from this one point where a decision was made. So the answer to that, of course, is not crystal clear. It's always fact-based. But there is a legal doctrine of attenuation is the idea that at some point the harm that you're talking about is too remote. The consequence that you're talking about is too remote to really be attributable to the harm that you've identified. And so Richard Allen's attorneys, as I've said, they've argued that taint from the search warrant should extend all the way to his confessions in Westville several months later. I tend to think it's highly unlikely that the court would actually reach that conclusion. And the main reason why is because when you're looking at attenuation, there's not really a bright line rule, but some of the factors that will be important are intervening issues, intervening causes. And so when you're looking at everything that happened between the search warrant being served and Richard Allen making these confessions in Westville, there's just so many things that had to happen beyond the warrant and the search of the home, beyond just the fact of the arrest, even for those things to come into play. You had to have the safekeeping order. You had to have the decision to put him in solitary confinement. You had to have his pre-existing psychological frailty. You had to have the deterioration and so forth. And so it's not like it necessarily would follow all the time that a search warrant being falsified is going to produce an outcome like this. The ones that are really clear and obvious are the ones that the court tends to focus on. And so the most obvious one is, well, what did you get in that search? And then often things that are immediately derivative from what you found in that search. And so, for example, as a result of this search, they likely were able to, well, it wouldn't matter in this case because they never matched his DNA to anything, but like, things like that, derivative things like the ballistics testing, the fact that they were able to get the gun and then fire the gun and do the analysis with it and so forth. They didn't get the ballistics testing directly from the search warrant, but they were only able to do it because they recovered the gun that was predicated on that warrant. So that's going to be a question for the Court of Appeals is attenuation, and at what point do you have to cut off that causal chain and say, you know, this is too remote, that isn't necessarily caused so exclusively by the search warrant, but these other things, on the other hand, would be. And so how does that affect the totality of the evidence that would have been presented to the jury?
Yeah, I feel like it's just an interesting case study because, like, just on its face, like, well, your search warrant for this doesn't gonna affect the fact that he confessed later. But in this particular case, it's like you're able to so clearly connect those dots,
mm-hmm.
you know? But, you know, I agree that it probably, from what I've seen in the court system, unlikely that a judge would go that far with it. But it's interesting to me because, you know, like I'm in college right now studying for criminal justice. So I've done a lot of coursework on the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine as taught to detectives, officers,
mm-hmm.
and the things we need to worry about. And like, it's from our side of it, it's taught that this, like scenarios like this, like if you do something wrong and violate someone's rights to get information, it can go, you know, it's like just it's to scare officer. You know, it's like it sure. can go all the way. Everything that ever happened after that could be. And so it's interesting to hear, like, in practice, in court, like where the line gets drawn. And I knew the answer was going to be it's very squishy and it depends on, you know, how far the judge rules. But it was just curious to hear your take on it, because it's such a unique situation where it's like, you know, you could see where like they find something in the search warrant that gets them to arrest him. And he's just sitting in the county jail and confesses to somebody. It's like, well, he might have confessed to anybody. You know, it's easy to make that argument. In this case, it's just such a cause and effect all the way down the line. It's super interesting to me.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Yeah, unfortunately for anybody who's not a lawyer, the answer that you routinely get is very unsatisfying. It depends. It's just, it's very hard to put things in real black and white terms legally. It's not just that. It's not just that the law is often ambiguous, but the reality that I've found after dealing in the system with you know, for decades and seeing all kinds of different judges and how they handle cases and things like that is that it's just a lot comes down to personality and how people think and how they engage with the case really affects how they apply the law, how they interpret the law. I'll give you an example of how something like that could play out in this particular appeal. I mentioned that the last category that he's raised, the general denial of his right to present a defense, it's broken up into, I want to say, like 18 subcategories. I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot of very individual errors. And so one of the things that you always have to deal with in an appeal context is that just because there is an error doesn't mean you're going to get a new trial. Right. The court follows very much a no harm, no foul type of analysis when it comes to appeals, because, I mean, ultimately, they don't want to be wasting their time. If it wouldn't have made a difference, it's just academic. This error took place, then they're not going to go through the process and the upheaval and everything of forcing the trial court to do it all over again. But so then how do you analyze whether there is no harm and no foul? You could potentially, in this third error, let's say we find that there are like five of the things that they've alleged are errors. If we look at each one of those individually in isolation and say, okay, error number one, did that affect the outcome of the trial? But for this error, would Richard Allen not have been convicted? It's much easier to do that when you look at these errors in isolation than if you said, well, there's five of them. And if you take all five of these things together and cumulatively look at the impact of what that would have had on the trial, you might have a different perspective on how significant those errors were. So a lot of this, you know, I hate to be too much of a legal realist and kind of fall back on the position of, well, it's just judges are going to do what the judges are going to do. But the reality is that very much is a part of the practice of law, that the rules give you the guidelines and the structure for these types of decisions to be made. But there's always some flexibility in the interpretation and how they get applied. And so how the judge wants to rule can have a big effect on what the outcome actually is. And that's one of the things that I think was extremely well done with Richard Allen's appeal brief, is it was written in a way that, in my view, makes it very clear how unfair this process was. And so you read the brief and you get a sense of this man should get a second shot. And so being able to get that motivational piece in place with the court is such an important part of the appellate process, because if they want to rule for you, then they can look at the law through that framework, through that perspective, and apply it in a way that permits them to get to that outcome.
I thought when the trial was over, and just looking at it from somebody who investigates wrongful convictions all the time, it looked to me like, I said, I have zero confidence in the conviction. I think the conviction should be overturned, and at the very least, you should get a new trial. But then I look at, you know, the hurdles that they have to jump through, and it seemed like there's only one of two ways that are going to be a clear way to get out of this. And one is going to be, you've got to find some way to find an error in the confessions, because I feel I've just seen in other states so many times where it's like, there's all this evidence, there's this. It doesn't matter what you do. They're always going to say it wouldn't have materially affected the outcome of the trial because confession.
Yes.
So like you can remove the gun, you can remove this, you can remove this. The jury heard him confess. That's not going to change the outcome of the trial. Yes. So it's like you're going to have to go after that confession.
And in post-conviction, especially, you see that a lot, because you have challenges to guilty pleas. You have a situation where somebody was, you know, you're facing death or something like that, and you just don't have a very good chance of potentially beating that. So you take a plea in order to save your own life. But there is abundant evidence that you're not guilty. Comes up all the time in the post-conviction process, the difficulty of trying to establish, you know, Here's an alibi witness. Here's proof I couldn't have been there. Here's DNA of somebody else. But the fact that you pled guilty will sometimes be enough to prevent the court from finding that there is a manifest injustice here that needs to be corrected.
Yeah, and so it seems like that's where you got to go. Or, and that's usually, you know, where Innocence Projects bring me in to try to do, is you got to find out who did it. You know, through forensic testing or something like that. You have to show them, I can tell you Richard Allen didn't do it, because this other person did it with some kind of evidence. And of course, that'll all have to come in after the direct appeals, right? Before they ever get to new evidence or anything like that.
You know, so in Indiana, my understanding is that they don't have to wait for the appeal to be concluded in order to start that process.
Oh, really?
There are some, in my state you do, but in Indiana, there are some post-conviction remedies that you can pursue pretty much immediately. One of them that I would love to see personally is they have post-conviction DNA testing, and I would love to see a push for some of these samples to be submitted for some of this, you know, next generation whole genome type of sequencing that is, it's been shown to be just much more useful in situations where you have partial or degraded profiles. There was very recently in the case in the Long Island serial killer, Rex Huerman. There was some litigation about next-gen technology that was used in that case, specifically because what they had was a very limited sample that wasn't going to be useful for a conventional STR testing, but they can just develop so much more genetic information through these other methods that allows them to be able to make extremely strong comparisons. So I would love to see something like that being pursued, because again, the DNA just remains one of the most probative pieces of evidence. And sure, it's possible that it's there because they live in a communal house and multiple people live there and do the laundry together and stuff like that. But if you get a profile from somebody that's not in the household, well, that should be raising some enormous red flags. And then particularly if that should happen to correspond with anybody that's been in the network of potential suspects that were looked at, it would be a huge piece of the puzzle. And so such a critical piece of information, I would love to see that being pursued. There does seem to be a legal pathway to do it. I don't know much about the logistics of it, if there are cost issues or things like that are at play. But to me, that just remains the most important of the unsolved, unexamined issues that could potentially be a game changer.
Yeah, I agree. And hopefully that gets done. So I think I've got one question from a listener that I'm going to throw at you. It's going to be a hard one for you to answer. And then we're going to go ahead and wrap. I think this has been an incredible, at least for me, an incredible, like, better understanding of what's happening and a great recap of everything that went from the perspective of somebody who was there. Michael Osbrook has been in the chat yapping away this whole time. And
I hope he's corrected everything I've got wrong, because I'm sure I've missed some details here and there.
Well, I really want to get into like what the but I'm currently sick and trying not to lose my voice. But I want to get into like the new evidence and the new things that have come out since the trial. But I think I'm going to try to get Michael to come on maybe next week or sometime soon so we can start covering that stuff, too. But for now, this has been an awesome analysis. And I do want to share from listener Amy. She has a question. Andrea, do you think the conviction will ultimately be overturned?
Yeah, this is a very hard question, because the disadvantage that I have is that this isn't my home court. I don't know these players. If this was in my court, I would be able to tell you, yeah, I can get a new trial for this guy in my court that I've been practicing in for 15 years. I know the judges. I know how they think. I know how to present things to them. I could get this man a new trial in my court. I don't know this court. And so I don't know what the leanings are. I don't know what the politics are. I just don't know how they're going to receive something like this. I think there is plenty of reason to be highly alarmed with it from both a factual standpoint and a legal standpoint. I certainly think that if they want to reverse it, they have ample grounds to do it. But that can often just be the biggest hurdle, is getting the court to want to reverse it. Courts tend to be very conservative when it comes to overturning convictions. They like to leave things settled. They like the judgment to be final and to not have to mess with it. So overcoming that can be quite a challenge. If there's any case where it seems like it should get your attention and it should tweak you in the conscience about the fairness of it, this case really seems to be it. But as far as predicting, it's not something I can comfortably do without knowing who the players are that are making the decision.
Let me frame it to you a different way, and this will be my last question for you. Without predicting what's gonna happen, you witnessed the entire trial. You've read all these briefs. You've read this appeals brief. If Andrea Burkhart was the appeals judge, mm-hmm. was the appellate judge mm-hmm. reviewing this case based on what you know from the trial and the appellate brief, do you have an opinion on how you would rule on it if you were the judge?
If I'm the judge, I am giving him a new trial, and I'm giving him a new trial on the denial of the defense basis. There's enough there that he should have been able to get into, and particularly when it comes to the things like explaining the crime scene and the investigative leads that weren't pursued and so forth, that just created such an uneven playing field that the jury gets a distorted picture of what happened. And so I have to have a little bit of thought for the jury as well, because they voted to convict him based on what they were presented. And it's not an easy job being a jury. It's a very, very heavy responsibility having somebody's life in your hand. And so you don't want to cavalierly suggest, you know, they got it wrong. But this is a context where they didn't have all the information. And so it's only fair that a jury has to live with itself for the decision it made. And I would be thinking to myself, if I were a juror here that voted to convict and I learned all of this stuff that has only now come out through the appeal process and through the post-conviction motions and so forth, would I be feeling good about the decision I had made? And I just don't see how, for me personally, that could be the case. So I would be looking to give him a new trial to allow him to present the evidence that he wasn't allowed to present.
Well, thank you so much for that very direct answer and for giving us all of your time to break down both the trial and the post-conviction stuff. It's great to meet you in person, finally.
Always a pleasure. Yeah.
And I really appreciate you coming on. And with that, we're going to wrap this thing up. And Michael, I know you're hearing me. We're going to try to get Michael next week to continue the conversation about Delphi. And we'll talk about all this in our follow-up, which we'll be recording in just a few days. Thanks, everybody. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.